quote one of my favorite poems, fairy tales are full of impossible things. We hear of people's dreams of fairy tale romances or fairy tale weddings and assume that these people are after perfect happy endings. However, the reality of fairy tales are far from the gilded gorgeousness and eternal happiness people often link them to. Fairy tales are full of impossible, often dark and horrific things. But before we get into the subversive contents of fairy tales, before Disney lightened them up and then made a series of remakes to capitalize upon our own nostalgia, let's talk a bit about how fairy tales came to be. Welcome to Not So Familiar History. I'm Helen Gunn.
And I'm David Cirillo.
To begin, fairy tales are stories that are designed to teach a lesson, or are didactic in nature. They teach its audience valuable life lessons, something we mortals call morals. At the same time, violent, scary events teach children that bad things happen to bad people. As in, if you are a bad kid, the devil will come for you. Or if you are jealous of someone's beauty, your body will be flayed and thrown into a barrel. On the bright side, however, good things often happen to good people. If you endure abuse with a smile, you'll get to marry a prince. If you fall in love with an anthropomorphic beast, then you will also marry a prince. And finally, if you are raped and bear the children of an already married king, you'll also get to marry that king after his wife is punished with death for being angry at him for cheating. Wait, that doesn't sound right. Anyways, fairy tales were told long before.
Holy.
I know, right? That's actually the original version of Sleeping Beauty. It's Italian. It's about the same time period as Perrault, too, interestingly enough. But anyways, fairy tales were told long before everyday people knew how to read or write. As such, they were originally told aloud. Fairy tales follow an oral tradition where stories would be passed down by mouth, so people could remember them. Many fairy tales follow a rule of three. For example, there are three siblings where two siblings are lazy and bad and the third is good, or there are three trials or tasks that must be completed, or three chances for the character to get something right. So these patterns exist, and oftentimes patterns exist in good writing. But while we know good writing exists under the rule show, don't tell, because of the oral nature of fairy tales, they had to follow a different rule, tell, don't show. Stories contained very basic descriptions, where the story would tell readers what was happening without showing how it was happening or how it looked. And additionally, characters in fairy tales are static. So static characters are not dynamic. There isn't much to them. They don't change or grow. Their only purpose is to carry the plot towards its ending. So if you're looking for a complex character, look elsewhere. Because of its sparse detailing along with built-in patterns, these stories, though, were able to live on and be written down by future generations because they were just so easy to remember. Now for the fun parts of fairy tales. They often contain magic, trials that must be overcome by the main character, and a happy ending. So the characters exist in a magical world where they must find their own way to a happy ending. Perhaps they must fight magic with magic or believe that the impossible is just within their reach. However, this magical reality needs its reader or listener's acceptance too. Thus, fairy tales use something called intuitive logic, which means that it asks the reader to just go with and accept its strange plot. There isn't usually an explanation for why things happen, they just do. As a side note, this lack of explanation is likely because adding background and explanations would make the story too hard to remember and be effectively retold. Anyway, fairy tales normalize magic. In the land of these tales, magical things happen all the time and the characters just accept it. There is no surprise, it's just normal. And maybe the best part about fairy tales, even better than normalized magic, is that guaranteed happy ending. Besides, isn't the quintessential ending line of a fairy tale, and they all lived happily ever after? Psych! Even with that famously overdone line, most of the endings are truly not all that happy. I mean, on the surface, it is happy, as the moral would be that good things happen if you are good. However, the path to this happiness is often fraught with unhappy, violent events. For example, princesses marry without giving consent, like in the 12 Dancing Princesses. The good guys have to witness the horrifying deaths of bad guys, like in Sleeping Beauty. And problems are often solved due to the burden of huge sacrifices, like Donkey Skin or Podan, one of my favorite fairy tales. So while the ending appears happy, the truth of it is not. But what about the stories we love? The ones we watched breathlessly on VHS as children? Well, that's easy. As time passes, so too do cultures change. I believe parents grew to decide against traumatizing their children through macabre tales about what might happen if you aren't good. Many fairy tales have multiple versions, usually a more modern, kid-friendly one, and a darker, even horrific one. And to delve a bit more into this phenomenon of fairy tale retellings, we're going to look at an old favorite, Cinderella.
Cinderella tales are cyclical tales in which heroines are introduced as living in a middle to upper class with a loving father proper to their character, birth, and other traits, but which they leave or are forced out of. The heroines must prove themselves and engage in work or adventure to find their way back into the class and environment in which they belong. These tales generally reward the good, clever, and fair, and punish the wicked while revealing significant ideas about the gender and class relations prevalent within the societies and time periods the tales come from. Personally, I've always had a really deep attachment to Cinderella. I watched the Disney movie so many times that the VHS tape gave out, though I'm not sure many people really know what a VHS tape is nowadays, but it had to be spun in the olden days.
I mean, I'm thinking that most of the people that are listening to this know what VHSs are.
It depends, because we're trying to relate to both the VHS crowd and the TikTok cottagecore crowd.
I guess
crowd.
You're right.
So, it's an odd dichotomy.
It's basically a vintage movie, guys.
So I also owned and adored all the sequels, and that's not even going into my love for Sondheim and therefore Into the Woods. But there is much more to Cinderella than was shown through the Disney sheen or even through Sondheim's rhymes. So many different versions we could focus on, taking up hours of your precious day. Variations of the Cinderella story are found in numerous cultures spanning millennia, but the oldest version of the story is considered to be from the 1st century BCE, about a Greek courtesan named Rhodope in an age-old story of good versus evil. There's also Yixian in China, to Bawang Merah Bawang Putih in Indonesia, Beauty and Pock Face, another Chinese tale, and Cenerentola by the acclaimed Italian author Basile. Because there is so much ground to cover, we're going to focus on a few specific tales akin to Cinderella, focusing on the Vietnamese, Germanic, and French versions of the story. But don't worry, we still have plenty of time to talk about the modern versions we know and love, which, yes, include both the Anne Hathaway and Hilary Duff versions. Rhodope's story has actually been told over the centuries by multiple classical Greek figures, indicating that this tale is truly as old as time. The American classical scholar William F. Hansen notes that versions of the Cinderella story are usually grouped into two subsets: Western variants, in which the protagonist meets the prince before losing her shoe, and Eastern variants, in which she never meets him until after finding her shoe. The story of Rhodope, as told by Strabon, falls into the category of the Eastern variants, whereas Perrault's classic version falls into the Western category. First, we're going to retell a story of the former variety, a story of Tam and Cam from Vietnam. This isn't Cinderella, to be fair, but its plot is so similar that it would be a shame not to include the invigorating and imaginative story of Tam and Cam. Tam and Cam are two half-sisters. In A Tale as Old as Time, keeping in mind this version is actually a bit older than even that, Tam's mother dies, leaving her father to remarry. Unfortunately for Tam, her father died shortly after remarrying, and so Tam is left with her stepmother and her daughter, Cam. Like many Cinderella stories, Tam's stepmother is sadistic. She forces all the work upon Tam. Cam gets to lounge back, meanwhile, and bathe in her comparative laziness. On one occasion, however, Tam's stepmother does task Cam to go out with Tam to catch some shrimp, promising a new red yam, which is basically a bodice, to whoever caught the most. Tam caught a lot, she was a hard worker after all, but Cam didn't catch a thing. After years of disuse, it's a wonder her hands even worked at all. Nonetheless, like many who feel entitled to things they did not earn, Cam felt she deserved that yam. She tells her stepsister to wash her hair, muddy from catching all these shrimp. While her stepsister complies, Cam steals Tam's shrimp and runs home. This is the part where the fairy godmother comes in, except it's actually a wise old man called Etienne, who often helps the downtrodden in Vietnamese folklore. He peers into her basket, where there's a single goby, a fish, not a berry. He tells her to raise this fish in a well with her rice, and so Tam follows his direction. The goby grows rapidly, and Tam suddenly has a friend. Tam would talk to the goby, and the goby would silently comfort her. Don't ask me how. Her stepmother, however, soon discovered her fishy friend, and ordered Tam to go far away to graze buffaloes. Cam, meanwhile, goes to the well in Tam's clothing to call up the goby from the rice, and then butchers the poor fish. And then they eat it. The old man reappears to tell Tam what happened, to tell her to collect the goby's bones, and then hide them under her bed. Not long after, the king hosts a festival. Tam and her family were all invited, but her stepmother has other plans, ordering Tam to intricately separate a pile of bran and rice. The old man appears once more with sparrows to help her, reciting a poem all the while to prevent them from eating the rice. O sparrows, go down and separate these grains of rice for me. Eat a grain, and I will beat you to death. The old man then tells her to dig up those jars that she had buried previously with the fish bones, which now contain silk clothes, a scarf, a red yam, and a tiny horse. The horse reminds me of one of those bath toys that grows with water, for the tiny horse grew 3 times that day, soon taking the size of a normal horse with a saddle and all.
All I could think about was Timothée Chalamet singing, "There he is, my tiny horse. He's extra tiny today."
Where is that from?
SNL, it's incredible. You've got to watch it.
I have not watched it, alas. But I can't think of Timothée Chalamet anymore without thinking about Armie Hammer eating him. Regardless. With her work done, Tam goes to the festival and drops a slipper in the process. The king rides past the same path that Tam just rode on with her horse, stopping when his elephant, yes, his elephant, stopped and growled at the spot, prompting the king to have his men look underwater, where they eventually find the slipper. He tells all the women at the festival to then try on the slipper. When Tam goes to try it on, her step-sibling and stepmother mock her, but it fits, and the king commands his people to lead her to wed him immediately. That's where the story usually ends, right? But not for Tam. Tam doesn't fully abandon her family, having too much respect for her past. She went home for the anniversary of her father's death to help her stepmother prepare, as is often the custom in Vietnamese tradition. Tam treats them kindly throughout the anniversary, and that's not reciprocated. Tam's stepmother actually then asks her to climb a tree to gather fruit. All the while, Tam's stepmother chops down the tree and Tam falls to her death. Soon after, Cam steals Tam's clothes and then goes to the king and tells him that Tam drowned in a pond by accident, claiming she was there to replace her sister as his wife. The king is saddened to hear so, but with no other choice, he marries Cam. He ignores his new wife, though, mourning for Tam silently. But Tam isn't really gone. She reincarnates into an oriole that flies to the king, singing to him. He responds, "O oriole, if you are my wife, enter my sleeve," and she does so. The king immediately believes that she has been reincarnated as the bird, and only spends time with it, ignoring Cam even more. He then builds a cage for Tam to reside in when they are not together, but much like with the goby, Cam butchers the oriole and eats it, and claims it flew away when trying to feed it. Where the feathers were buried, 2 peach trees grew, bending toward the king, a clear sign from Tam. The king has a cot put there so he can nap next to Tam every single day, but Cam soon chopped the trees down to build a loom. But the loom carries Tam all the same, and she can hear Tam scolding her. So Cam burns it, but the ashes float away and eventually land to grow a golden apple tree. An old woman soon crosses the tree and finds the apples to be so enticing that she brings one home to stand almost decoratively, not bearing to eat it. Soon she finds her housework magically done and a woman, Tam, appearing from the apple. She tears off the peel to allow Tam to exit the apple fully and then adopts the girl. The king stops by one day to rest, and the old woman offers betel leaf prepared in Tam's signature style, leading the king to ask, "Who made it?" And suddenly, Tam appears, and she is brought back to the palace immediately. When Cam sees Tam, she doesn't respond as one normally would after a series of murders, instead asking her for her beauty secret, in which Tam replies, "Do you want to be beautiful? I'll help you." Cam immediately agrees. Tam tells her to jump down a hole, and she does so, which is strangely trusting, again, for a task ordered to you by someone you've murdered multiple times. Tam then commands the royal soldiers to pour boiling water into the hole, killing Cam and using her corpse to make a fermented sauce in the same way that fish sauce is made. Tam then sends this sauce to her stepmother, saying it's a gift from Cam. The stepmother eats it every day. One day, a crow flies by and cries out, "Delicious! The mother is eating her own daughter's flesh. Is there any left? Give me some." When she reaches the bottom of the jar, she discovers a skull inside and realizes it's Cam's, and she dies out of shock. May I say, this must have been a very large jar to have a fully intact skull. Nonetheless, I love this rendition. It's dark and twisted, but overall bends towards happiness and optimism and love and rebirth. It's joyful in its revenge, and it's beautiful. The Vietnamese version touches upon many facets of traditional life, from catching shrimp and crab in the paddy fields, and taking the buffalo out to graze, to celebrating death anniversaries and offering a plate of betel nut to guests as a form of hospitality. There are a few religious elements in the story as well, including the belief in karma, that those who did good would eventually be rewarded, while those who did bad would be punished, expressed with the common Vietnamese phrase, "one good turn deserves another," or the alternative, "sow wind, reap storm." Being scalded to death by boiling water is reminiscent of scenes from Buddhist hell, where people being dipped in hot oil is quite common. Perhaps a not-so-subtle reminder for children to always be on their best behavior. And may I say, it also is a link to that one episode of Avatar The Last Airbender on Kyoshi Island, where being boiled in hot oil was a possible punishment for the Avatar.
Now onto our more well-known versions of the story. The 1800s brought the golden age of children's literature, hence why the Grimm Bros decided to log their versions of so many fairy tales. With the relatively new cheapness of printing books, lenders' libraries, and new publication ways of publishing in volumes and in periodicals rather than whole books, literacy was at an all-time high. No better time to scare the children. Grimm's version of our tale is a bit, well, grim, thus why it is I who will be describing it to you. In the Grimm version, Cinderella's mother died. However, before she died, she called Cinderella to her deathbed and asked her little girl to promise to remain pious and good. And of course, her daughter did so because, like, her mom was dying, and to not promise such a thing in the face of your mother's death would be kind of shitty. But this meant that Cinderella had to deal with an evil stepmother and sisters, their abuse, and her father's coldness without fighting back. The sisters and their mom took away all of Cinderella's beautiful things, treated her like a servant, and made her sleep in the cinders of the fireplace. Anyway, even her father becomes cold towards her and does not stick up for her, even though she is his true daughter, the daughter of his and his late wife. So, when he goes on a trip, he asks the three girls what they wish for him to bring back for them. Her sisters ask for beautiful dresses and jewels, while Cinderella only asks for the branch of a tree. Naturally, the father brings back the dresses and jewels, but only brings back that branch for Cinderella, and she decides to plant that branch on her mother's grave, and she cries so much that the branch grows into a big tree. Then after an unknown amount of years, a ball is announced. Of course, Cinderella is not allowed to go to the ball because, well, she doesn't know how to dance, but also she doesn't have a dress, and her family hates her. So she decides to sing to some birds, who then pick out some lentils from the fireplace for her, a task given to her by her evil stepmother. And then she sings to the tree, and a beautiful dress falls down to her, along with a pair of beautiful golden slippers. And she repeats this for 3 nights. And each night, her father has a little inkling his first daughter has caught the attentions of the prince, and then is like, "Nah, that's not Cinderella." At the same time, each night, Cinderella escapes so that she can get home before her family can find out she was out. Finally, very, very irritated by this, the prince decides to go on his crusade to get the girl, after Cinderella's father cut down her dead mother's magic tree, and the prince finds her sleeping in ashes, as is usual for this poor woman. And then they lived happily ever after. Except her sisters had tried to pull one over on the prince and had cut off parts of their feet so they could stuff their feet into Cinderella's little golden slipper. Sherlock that he is, the prince finds out because of the blood leaking from the shoes. And when Cinderella marries the prince, her terrible sisters try to suck up to her, but the birds Cinderella used to sing to come and peck their eyes out so that they might be blind for the rest of their lives. No better revenge than that. This version is the one used in Sondheim's Into the Woods, the musical that David mentioned earlier. Cinderella's story in Sondheim's rendition does not end with the happily ever after one expects. Instead, she decides to make her own way. She helps slay a giant, and she even turns her back on her cheating prince. She always did like house cleaning, ironically. This version has a poignancy that I think is very special and plays with the idea that one must be careful what one wishes for because it might come true, and that one's wish might not bring happiness. One must also bear in mind that children will see and learn from you, just as they do and did from fairy tales. And if you're interested in this fun, dark, gorgeous musical, it's on YouTube in its entirety, with Bernadette Peters and everything. But turning from the Grimm version, let's talk a bit about Perrault. His is the version that is perhaps most well known. It is the version that Disney used to make their wonderful 1950s version of Cinderella. I guess 500 years earlier? Nah, a little less than 500 years earlier. In 1697, we have Perrault's version of Le Petit Cendrillon, or Cinderella, and the Glass Slipper. In this one, she does have an evil stepmother and evil stepsisters, but her father is not a terrible person, because he's dead. So he has no hand in the way that she is treated. In this one, though, she also has that fairy godmother. Instead of singing to a tree and sort of making her own fate happen, the fairy godmother comes and makes it possible for her to have a beautiful dress with glass slippers. The sisters try their best to fit into the slippers when the prince finally comes to find his Cinderella, and they don't fit. There's no blood in this one, they don't lose their eyes, and there's this really annoying moral at the end, where they say, beauty in a woman is a rare treasure that will always be admired. Graciousness, however, is priceless and of even greater value. This is what Cinderella's godmother gave to her when she taught her to behave like a queen. Young women, in the winning of a heart, graciousness is more important than a beautiful hairdo. It is a true gift of the fairies. Without it, nothing is possible. With it, one can do anything. So, the first moral is, even if someone treats you like utter garbage, be gracious and nice to them. Because that's what you should do to your abusers. And the other moral, without doubt, it is a great advantage to have intelligence, courage, good breeding, and common sense. These and similar talents come only from heaven, and it is good to have them. However, even these may fail to bring you success without the blessing of a godfather or godmother. Isn't that awful?
So Cinderella, in the way we all know and love, was based mainly on Perrault's version, albeit much more 1950s. Perrault used Cendrillon to critique expectations for women of his time, to some extent. He was also very much bowing into French subservience. But the Disney version instead makes Cinderella into even more an active character, once again taking on attributes from his time of creation. She doesn't take many actions of her own, rather being led and helped by the animals and godmothers around her to a heightened extent. But the film, all the while, is magical. Walt Disney's rendition of Perrault's Cinderella is distinctive with Disney's style and flair, not to mention songs. Disney blended modernist fantasy with sentimental domestic tales where animals transparently stood in for humans, combining fantastic imagery along paths we're accustomed with, merging the new and the comforting. Keep in mind, this was one of Disney's first ventures into this animated arena as well, cementing their stature and supremacy in animation and vaulting the field forward by a large margin. After the Disney Renaissance of the 90s, which spurred multiple direct-to-VHS sequels of Cinderella, the 2000s had a Cinderella revival of their own through teen movies, mainly Ella Enchanted and A Cinderella Story, both of which I've watched within the past month, and the former of which I've watched at least 3 times within the past year. Cinderella, through Anne Hathaway's version, adds even more magical elements, from talking snakes to curses of obedience, all the while adding peppy queen sing-alongs. And Hilary Duff's version incorporates then-teen heartthrob Chad Michael Murray, while pushing the narrative even further into our modern Rome, taking it from Ella's medieval setting and transporting us to an American high school. The movie itself is iconic and has spurred many sequels, which creatively take the name and add words like another in front of it. And even the story of Tam and Cam was actually made into a movie, Tam Cam, The Untold Story, in 2016. Time and time again, Cinderella, Tam, Cendrillon, or whatever you like to call her, him, them, lives on. Cinderella takes the form and shape of whatever time and culture surrounds her because the story is relatable, often comforting, and gives something to believe in while providing a sense of comfort and familiarity. It'll surely be made again, likely by Netflix, into yet another spin-off of a Cinderella story. And we will watch it, and we will love it, because if humans have shown one thing, it's that we love to believe in something, even when it's a cautionary fairy tale. If you want to know more about different versions of Cinderella, pick up a version of Histoire du Conte du Temps Passé by Perrault, or maybe watch the newest adaptation of Tam and Cam, though it is in Vietnamese. Tell us what you think, and meanwhile, I'll keep throwing my shoes around town hoping a prince will find one. Thank you so much for listening to our latest episode of Not So Familiar History. You can find us wherever you prefer to stream your podcasts, and make sure to give us a good rating if you really enjoyed this episode. We appreciate you listening and hope to catch you again in 2 weeks for our next episode. See you then.